107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Alvinger. President Biden says he is ready to put an investigation into his handling of classified documents. Behind him, Special Counsel Robert Hur recommending no criminal charges, despite finding Mr. Biden willfully retained materials. Hur's report also pointing out distinctions between the cases of President Biden and former President Trump.
Contrast Mr. Biden turned in classified documents to the National Archives, the Department of Justice, consented to a search of multiple locations, including his homes, and sat for a voluntary interview, and in other ways cooperated with the investigation.
Mr. Biden reading part of the report to House Democrats. The Supreme Court's appeared critical of a Colorado Supreme Court decision which would ban Mr. Trump from the state's primary ballot, citing a clause in the 14th Amendment. Six members of a family are feared dead from a fire at a house in suburban Philadelphia. It went up in flames as two police officers responding to the scene were shot and wounded. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Wisconsin is cracking down on odometer rollbacks and title fraud. The Department of Motor Vehicles says it revoked the licenses of 32 wholesale vehicle dealer licenses in the last 2 months. Two dealers rolled back more than 6 million miles on about 64 vehicles. The agency says the problem is bad actors among Wisconsin's wholesale car dealers. President Biden and Donald Trump are tied in Wisconsin in the latest Marquette University Law School poll.
49-49 with registered voters, 50 for Trump, 49 for Biden with likely voters. When we add in third-party votes, it stretches to a three-point Trump lead.
Poll director Charles Franklin on the Devil's Advocate show on Civic Media. The election is 9 months away. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News. Now here's what you need to know closer to home.
More news from the Center WRCE, I'm Jimmy Kuska. A school administrator was reinstated after being placed on leave for the past few weeks. Derek Fugslang, Stoddard Elementary's principal and Fayette teacher, was put on leave last month for violating policy and procedure and bringing complaints about the district administrator directly to the DeSoto School Board. The district superintendent accused Fugslang of harassment for citing her age and health and questioning her ability to do her job. The school board reinstated Fugslang, but decided not to renew his contract for next year, citing budget concerns. A large crowd turned out for the meeting in support of Fugslang, but public comment wasn't allowed. The district is holding a referendum this spring to help fund school operations. One person is dead after being hit by a vehicle last night in Sauk City. Police said that the person was walking across Highway 12 at about 7:30 when they were hit. The person was taken to Sauk Prairie Hospital, where they later died. The driver of the vehicle was not hurt, and police said that alcohol and speed were not factors in the crash. The driver stayed at the scene and cooperated. For WRCE, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Jim from Racine, welcome. What do you got for us?
Hey, Jim.
I voted for Reagan back in the day. I guess I've been supporting more of the Democratic Party for the last 40 years or so, but people are going to say, oh, man, she's a Republican. She's a Democrat. She's whatever. I'm a human being. All these other things aren't important. We need to unite against a bigger threat. I think the threat is us becoming a dictatorship. They want us to fail.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Bucks made some trades. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks making moves at the NBA trade deadline. They've picked up guard Patrick Beverley from the 76ers in exchange for their second round pick in the 2027 draft. The move seen as a way to improve on defense. Beverley is 35 years old, played for Doc Rivers when he was the head coach in Philadelphia. To make room, the Bucks traded Robin Lopez, the twin brother of Brooke, to the Sacramento Kings for cash considerations. The Kings then expected to release him, making him a free agent. The Bucks hosting the Timberwolves tonight. College hoops, the Badgers losing in Michigan last night, 72-68. How did the 11th-ranked team in the nation lose to a team with an 8-15 record? Head coach Greg Gard.
Yeah, I mean, if I had the answer for that, Mike, you know, I'd be, could bottle it and sell it. Why it happens sometimes, I mean, why do we go Sunday and have five turnovers and today we're throwing it everywhere? We'll break down the film and I'll get a better look of how and why. And then it's just an accountability factor.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy sky tonight, couple of showers around and breezy with lows in the mid-30s. Mostly cloudy for tomorrow, cooler, highs in the mid-40s. Sunshine back for the weekend, upper 30s. The trend for dry weather continues through most of next week as temps warm up into the 40s. Currently it's 56.
The Todd Alba Show.
I'm Trigvi Olsen. Steven from Green Bay. Go ahead.
The city of Green Bay is one of the best places in Wisconsin to live. Plenty of people that are Wisconsin nice.
Totally agree. Green Bay is kind of swing territory between the two parties, but people in Green Bay work together. I mean, people aren't asking themselves, am I wearing a red hat or a blue hat? They're wearing green and gold hats.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. From Hillsboro to Highland, your choice for news, talk, and sports is News from the Center, WRCE, 1450 AM and 107.7 FM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to a best-of version of the Maggie Dawn Show, where Maggie covers the consequences of the shadow docket used by the United States Supreme Court. To see every full edition of the Maggie Dawn Show, head over to the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us/shows.
It's the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am your host, Maggie Dawn. With me this afternoon is Anya Esther in the production booth. Welcome, everybody. 844-967-2789. Yesterday, I did a deep dive on the history of the Supreme Court's powers and the evolution of its shadow docket, which was a term coined by University of Chicago law professor in 2015. The professor's name is Will Bodie. He's actually a conservative. He didn't mean it pejoratively, but it certainly has come to take on that meaning. And I brought us up to the point in the 80s when the Supreme Court, without a change in law, without telling anybody, fundamentally started to change its practice about how it hears emergency petitions. We're going to get to that in just a second, but I have to just, the article that dropped about the settlement reached in the fake electors case. Good on you, Wisconsin law forward, but boy, is this some buck passing of like the highest order. They are not paying any money, despite the fact that it cost Milwaukee County and Dane County an incredible amount of money to defend these spurious lawsuits, none of which won. And they agreed to never serve as electors in the future or to participate in the transmission of such documents again. How about this? How about you can't, you're going to like forfeit your license to practice law for a couple of these folks, at least for a period of time? You agree to not run for public office? And maybe like you will have to pay a whole lot of money if you engage in bald-faced lies about elections that undermine Wisconsinites' faith in them in the future. It's so hard for me to swallow it. Here's the statement. The elector defendants took the foregoing action because they were told that it was necessary. Told by whom? Well, the Trump campaign and the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Because they were told that it was necessary to preserve their electoral votes in the event a court challenge may later change the outcome of an election. They signed these fake elector things the day after the state Supreme Court rejected the legal challenge. Yes, there were a couple of federal cases moving, but they weren't going anywhere fast and they did not amount to enough challenges to change the results. And by the way, those challenges were only in Milwaukee and Dane counties. I don't No, there wasn't a court challenge that was going to change the outcome. To preserve their electoral votes, they're not their electoral votes, they're ours, aren't they? It's sort of like faux contrition. I'm sorry you feel that way because I'm such a jerk all the time is not a legit apology. Neither is this. Okay. But I promised us all some deep dive on the Supreme Court, so I'll just gently pivot back to that. That was gobsmacking to me. And you're going to want to keep it locked all hour today because, boy, do we have an exclusive. Back on November 6th, I had Journal Sentinel reporter John Dietrich join us talking about the investigative reporting that John has done, a series of articles in partnership with the O'Brien Fellowship at Marquette University's School of Journalism about gun ownership in the state of Wisconsin, suicide rates. Quite an incredible bit of reporting. Been working on this for over a year. Well, they just dropped the next article this morning that has been in the series of articles and reporting that Mr. Dietrich and the Journal Sentinel has done. So I'm really happy I was able to get John to come and join us here this afternoon. So he's going to be with us at the bottom of the hour, followed there then by the executive director of Legal Aid, the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. You're not going to want to miss any of that, but let's get to the juicy business. When we last left our heroes, we were looking at the Supreme Court in the 80s. And what sort of started to change the way that the Supreme Court hears emergency appeals. And remember, there's two kinds of ways that the court hears or makes decisions that aren't in full, right? The things that we think about, like the abortion decision was like this 80-page thing, and it gets lots of press, and that's what most of us think of and talk about. That was the Roe v. Wade decision. That's the merits docket. But that's actually a small slice of what the court does. The vast majority of its work is in deciding which cases to hear. That's called the certiorari process. And then there are these requests for emergency action. And these requests for emergency action ask the court basically to prevent something from happening or allow something to happen. And there's supposed to be an emergency, like, you know, somebody's going to be executed. That's an emergency. And so we're not talking about the cert process, which is the vast majority of, that's huge bundles of what the court does, because they don't hear much of what they're requested to hear. In fact, I think one of the last statistics I heard, it's somewhere less than like 3% of cases that parties request the Supreme Court to hear, does the Supreme Court actually agree to hear? So when we last left this discussion, I had queued up that the courts had made the federal death penalty a non-starter. They had put a moratorium in place in 1972. In 1976, they said, "Eck, we're wrong. Let's start killing people again." And so there was a whole bunch of people that were basically in line to be killed by the federal government. And so a whole bunch of executions get scheduled. So you see this massive uptick. The executions are getting scheduled. So you see this big, huge uptick in these emergency requests for the Supreme Court to say, hold on, don't kill this person. There are some constitutional questions. Here's the statistic. In the 60s, the Supreme Court would receive 3 to 4 emergency death penalty requests per year. By 1983, they were receiving over 80. So like huge, huge change. And in 1988, the court stopped doing what it had done for decades. So before 1988, when the emergency death penalty request would come in, the United States was divided into 9 districts, and a single Supreme Court justice would decide that emergency, that request to stop the execution or to permit the execution to occur. They didn't speak on behalf of the court. There were often sort of abbreviated arguments in chambers, and a single judge would oftentimes write a short little decision addressing the emergency state. There was some deliberation. There was some argumentation. There were some written decisions. And you know who made the decision. It was the one justice. Well, in 1988, they got rid of it. They said, nope, the full court is going to hear all emergency applications. They did this on their own. They didn't tell a single person. It just changed one day. The interesting thing was not only did it go from one justice to all nine of them, those decisions on emergency applications that just one day in 1988 started to be handled differently, no decision, no argument, no briefing, all nine of them vote, but no one knows who voted which way. So there's no attribution of who decided which way on these various emergency requests. Okay, way different than the way that they did it for decades and decades and decades before. And what you see in the 80s then, because there was this backlog effectively of executions waiting to happen, what you see in the 80s is a spate of 5-4 decisions on emergency death penalty applications to the court. So there is not unanimity about how they should handle these things. And what's really pernicious here is that there were many, many instances where they're not denying a stay of the execution, okay? So this a stay of the execution would be the lower courts have ruled that the execution can proceed, no constitutional infirmities, and the person facing execution still goes to the court, the Supreme Court, and says, we think you will find constitutional problems. Please stop my execution from happening. Arguably, when the court turns those down, that's slightly less problematic because the lower courts didn't find any basis on full arguments and briefing to hold or stop the execution. But what ends up happening is that there are far more cases in the 80s where it's not the person that's going to be killed that is asking the court to change what's happening. It's the state that is seeking to execute the person. So this is really important. In those cases, what's happening is that lower courts found that there were constitutional problems and said this person shouldn't be executed. And the state disagrees, and it's appealing to the Supreme Court. But before there's any arguments before the Supreme Court, the state asks for the court to step in on an emergency basis, not to stop an execution, but to allow the state to kill the person. And the most pernicious thing here is that those emergency applications, you have to effectively, there has to be some finding by the court, even though they don't explain it, that the state is somehow harmed if they don't get this emergency relief. Explain to me, how is the state harmed by not being able to kill someone when lower courts with full argument have found that there are constitutional problems? One would think that the most drastic measure any government can take, which is killing one of its citizens, should only be undertaken in the most extraordinary circumstances, and certainly not when other judges have found that there are problems. But we see many, 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 it ends up being tens of tens of tens each year of the Supreme Court on emergency bases unstaying executions. And no one is paying any attention. Because unless you are the victim, the victim's family, the state itself, the person who's going to get executed, or the person who's going to be executed, their family, it doesn't affect you. So
this is News from the Setter, WRCE. Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on News from the Center. 107.7 FM and 1450 AM WRCE. And on the Civic Media app.
It's 2024. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air, coming to you live across the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Jane Matt Nair.
And I'm Greg Bach.
Join us Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to noon as we break down the news and share some laughs along the way.
We're talking to politicians, we're talking to community leaders, and we're talking to anyone who has a story.
And we occasionally get a visit from an umbrella cockatoo. Join us for Matt Nair on Air, Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to noon.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to a best-of version of the Maggie Dawn Show, where Maggie covers the consequences of the shadow docket used by the United States Supreme Court. To see every full edition of The Maggie Dawn Show, head over to the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us/shows.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you want to join our discussion about the Supreme Court shadow docket or about the great research and reporting Mr. Dietrich has done for the Journal Sentinel, you can always give us a call, 844-967-2789. That number takes text messages, too. Very handy. I will get to you. So before we heard some important messages, I had explained how all of a sudden in the 80s, the Supreme Court changes how it handles emergency death penalty requests. And now, without knowing which justices voted which way on a bunch of split decisions, they basically are saying, oh, yes, state, go ahead and execute these people without any briefing, without any argument, and without them having to explain themselves in situations where lower courts found constitutional infirmities. That's scary. By the way, still going on. And nobody was paying attention because, again, the stakes for those involved in those executions, very, very high, literally life and death. But beyond that small circle of people, those things happen without much notice. And even within the death penalty space, what happens in John Smith's emergency request from Missouri often doesn't have anything to do with Mr. Doe's request coming out of Florida. So even within the death penalty space, the cases didn't have much to say to one another. But all of a sudden, this manner of handling emergency appeals, emergency requests. So we have this change in 1988, and then it changes again. There's no change in the law. There's no announcement. The Supreme Court doesn't say, hey, in the interest of transparency and accountability, dear American public, we are the highest court in the land. Now hear this, we're going to do something differently again. In the 2010s, all of a sudden, they started to receive and use this same black box approach to emergency requests outside of the death penalty space, in the regulatory space. And the vast amount of what gets brought before the Supreme Court are criminal cases and regulatory cases. Does this federal agency have the power to make this rule or enforce this regulation and law in this way? And all of a sudden, the Supreme Court one day just drops an unauthored, unattributed, unexplained order granting an emergency stay on then-President Obama's climate agenda. It was the requirement that every state reduce its carbon emissions by 2030. And the vote on that one happened in the middle of the night. They didn't write an opinion. They hadn't heard an argument. A brief had not been filed in the Supreme Court. No arguments, no attribution. 5-4. It happened in February of 2016. In June of 2017, the court unstayed Trump's travel ban 2.0. They allowed the Muslim ban to go into effect. You may remember this. It was like all of a sudden you woke up in the morning and like a whole bunch of people from a whole bunch of countries couldn't come into the United States. You're like, wait a minute, did I miss a case here somewhere? Wait, that the Supreme Court did that? I didn't hear that. There weren't even arguments before the Supreme. You were right. They just did it in the middle of the night. Black box shadow docket. This is the last shift. So now these new procedures that had only been used in death penalty cases are used in case after case after case that have statewide and national consequences, that change rights and privileges overnight, that change federal policies overnight. COVID policies, voting rules, Biden's OSHA rules, immigration things, our healthcare rights. President Biden's loan forgiveness plan, that was not a fully briefed case. It was the black boxed shadow docket. There's nowhere else in our system of government where rights can be so fundamentally impacted without any accountability or explanation. It simply doesn't exist anywhere else. Whatever you think about the regulations that the EPA or the FDA or the FCC may come about, there's a note and comment period. There's a legal process that is transparent. There are FOIA laws, Freedom of Information Act requests. There is accountability and transparency, except here for the highest court in the land. The most notable example of this just happened in April of this year. On Good Friday, a known anti-abortion, anti-choice judge, part of the Christian nationalist movement in Amarillo, Texas, decided, mifepristone not available for women to use anymore. A 20-year FDA approval was wiped off the map by the Fifth Circuit judge. It then went to the Supreme Court. You remember this? Everybody freaked out. No mifepristone. What's going on? And within a matter of weeks, the Supreme Court lifted the stay in the middle of the night that judge had put in place and restored access to mifepristone. You may agree or disagree with that decision, but that ain't supposed to be the way things work. Unauthored opinion, no accountability, no rationale given. And there are more and more of these cases every year where emergency requests are being used to fundamentally shape our rights and liberties and the way that we live our lives every day. Here's the statistic. The number of total requests for emergency intervention by the Supreme Court under both the Bush and Obama administrations, that is 16 years, folks. The total number of those, 8. The total number of requests during the Trump administration, 4 years, a quarter of the time, 41. I'm going to say these numbers again. 16 years over two different presidential double terms, one Republican, one Democrat, 8 emergency requests to the Supreme Court during the 4 years of President Trump's administration, 41. And it is being used, and it was extraordinarily leveraged during the Trump administration, and the statistics bear this out, to effectively put policies into effect before they had full legal review. And when you're talking about banning countries and people from coming in because they have a different religious belief, which seems to be something in our founding that had to do with religious freedoms, I don't know. When the issues strike at the very foundational principles of our democracy, of our republic, one would think perhaps not through emergency interim decision-making by the Supreme Court dropped in the middle of the night with no authorship attribution, no explanation, no briefing, no written arguments, no accountability whatsoever. My point, folks, is this ain't the way it is supposed to work. And I'm not quite done yet. We're going to have reporter Mr. Dietrich hang on for a second. Because if you're sitting there thinking, well, I like the way the Supreme Court is deciding these things.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio, refreshed.
Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The daughter of an inmate who killed himself at the Waupun State Prison is suing state prison officials. Megan Hoffman says they didn't give him adequate mental health care and medication. Dean Hoffman was found dead in his cell in 2023 on his ninth day in solitary confinement. He's one of at least three inmates who died at Waupun that year. Misinformation is distorting the immigration debate, so says V.